From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Thursday marks President Trump's sixth month in office, but a new poll will not be cause for celebration. According to the Washington Post ABC News poll, Trump's six-month approval rating is the lowest for any president in the past 70 years. Just 36% of Americans approve of the job he's doing. 63% say it was not appropriate for Trump's son to take that meeting with a Russian lawyer and a lobbyist. The president is still defending today. This morning he tweeted, "Most politicians would have gone to a meeting like the one Don Jr. attended in order to get info on an opponent. That's politics." Trump also called claims of Russia interfering in the election a hoax, but 6 in 10 Americans in this new poll say it wasn't, and 67% think Trump's aides helped the Russians interfere. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is here. Ron, not a good poll for the president.
You know, politics does not seem to be a nice business, Robin. Mm-hmm. That's what the president was telling us over the weekend. And, you know, it's not something that most Republicans want to talk about right now if they're elected office holders. They'd rather talk about the economy or tax reform or the perceived failures of Obamacare, because there's really no good way to talk about the Russia probes, because the farther you go into it, the harder it gets to talk about and justify.
Yeah, well, and the president saying that this meeting with Russians was just politics. The poll found Americans saw it as inappropriate by a 2-to-1 margin. But that broke heavily along party lines. Are any of these revelations about that meeting changing anyone's opinion about the president?
If you go back to January, Robin, the president was +5 approval over disapproval in the average of polls that's done by 538.com, polling aggregating site. And if you look at it now, he's down to -15. That's a drop of 20 percentage points. That is a significant drop. And clearly, if there were a honeymoon at all, it did not last very long. And another poll that's just come out from the Wall Street Journal and NBC shows that in those counties that flipped from Obama in 2012 to Trump in 2016, and that's a substantial number of counties, by the way. It's 143 counties where they measured. In those counties, the support now for Donald Trump is well down under 50%. It's at 44. That's not that much above some of the other polls and the average of polls that we're seeing for approval nationwide among all voters.
But the support that there is seems to be hardening. We were reading in the Boston Globe a couple days ago about how Roger Stone, a former Trump advisor who's also a conspiracy theorist, he says Chelsea Clinton, for instance, that her father was not Bill Clinton. He's a 9/11 denier. He's been mocked. But last week, he was given a hero's welcome at an event for young GOP conservatives at a private club on Capitol Hill, where he said Democrats were on a witch hunt. He was cheered. He's been brought back from the dead. It seems President Trump's core is hardening its backing.
There is some truth in that. And perhaps we could say that that was also true in some past cases where you saw presidents who were under siege and some of their most enthusiastic supporters, often among their youngest supporters, were among the people who defended them to the last. We saw that certainly with Richard Nixon. And there was always a percentage of people who felt that Richard Nixon had been very unfairly treated in the entire Watergate matter.
Yesterday, President Trump, as we said, tweeting, much will be accomplished this week on trade, the military and security, but he is focusing on Russia. NBC's Chuck Todd asked Republican Senator John Cornyn on Meet the Press whether his claims that the meddling claim is a hoax is true. Let's listen.
It's a very serious matter that needs thorough investigation. I'm part of the Intelligence Committee along with Mark Warner, and we are going to get to the bottom of this.
But does calling it a hoax undermine trust?
I understand the president's frustration when James Comey told him 3 times he's not the target of an investigation, and he wants that made public. But this is not about President Trump. This is about Russia versus the United States, in my view.
Well, Ron, there have been reports of a White House shakeup. The president's lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, making the wrong kind of news, Politico reporting that he is an alcoholic who can't pass a security clearance, which, of course, makes it hard for him to get information to defend the president. Kasowitz then sent that expletive-laden email to someone who suggested he might want to step down. What's going on in the White House?
You know, all of this business about Russia, and Kasowitz is probably just one of many people who have been lawyers for Donald Trump who have been tried out as mouthpieces. Jay Sekulow is another who came on all five of the Sunday morning talk shows to defend the Trump White House, particularly with regard to Russia. All of these people are being tried out as spokespersons, and a lot of attention at the White House and a lot of attention on that Twitter account are going to this, and it's an enormous distraction from the biggest issue in Washington right now, which is, of course, the health care bill and the rest of the president's agenda before Congress. It's making the White House and the president himself spiked cannon. They can't do anything to move their agenda because they're so distracted by the Russia probes and by their own reaction to them and the way they've chosen to deal with them. This is a moment when mobilizing their base to make changes happen in Congress rather than to defend them on something like the Russia matter is really crucial to the long-term judgment that people will make, historically speaking, about the first 6 months of Donald Trump.
And speaking about the agenda, we know that the vote on the health care bill has been put off as John McCain recovers from surgery. Concerns about the bill, but also concerns about John McCain after having a blood clot removed. Ron Elving, NPR's senior Washington editor. Thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, the National Governors Association wrapped up its summer meeting over the weekend in Rhode Island, with many governors making a case against the Republican Senate health care bill. Next year, when the Democratic governors meet, they're going to have a new leader. Washington Governor Jay Inslee is set to take over as head of the organization from Connecticut's governor. Inslee has emerged as a fierce critic of President Trump. Austin Jenkins from the Northwest News Network partnered with the Seattle Times to look into the Washington governor's political ambitions. Here's his report.
Ever since President Trump was inaugurated, Washington Governor Jay Inslee has been popping up on cable news.
What is happening right now, Republicans are having a head-on collision with reality.
He's been on CNN, MSNBC, even Fox News. He's blasted the president over immigration, health care, climate change. And in doing so, Inslee's developed something of a national profile. And soon, he'll likely attract more attention. That's because in 2018, Inslee will chair the Democratic Governors Association, or DGA. He's currently vice chair. Inslee clearly sees this role in the context of the Resist Trump movement.
I'm no secret about it. I've talked to people who are intensely interested in having a pushback against Donald Trump, and the place to do that is in the governor's races.
2018 is going to be a big year for governor's races, 36 contests nationwide. So what will this mean for Inslee as chair of DGA? Kyle Condick is managing editor of Sabato's Crystal Ball. It's a politics and election newsletter published by the University of Virginia.
Of course, the Democrats are going to want to try to maximize the number of governorships they could win next year, and the DGA is a big part of that. So that makes Inslee a very important person in the 2018 campaign.
Inslee takes on this job at an interesting moment in history. Democrats hold just 16 governorships nationwide. Inslee's job is going to be to move that number up. He's already got a joke, delivered straight-faced, about the DGA's voter turnout operation.
We have a chairman that is incredibly effective at turning out Democrats. His name is Donald Trump.
Jokes aside, Republicans acknowledge they are on defense heading into 2018, not because of the president, but because they have to defend so many seats.
We're victims of our own success.
This is John Thompson with the Republican Governors Association. He doesn't accept the assumption that 2018 will be a good year for Democrats, and he accuses Inslee and other Democratic governors of overconfidence bordering on obnoxiousness when it comes to their 2018 prospects.
We've seen many, many times that governor's races are harder to nationalize. They're harder to connect to Washington. They're not like a Senate or congressional race.
Republicans do hold one clear advantage, money. In 2016, the RGA outraised the DGA by more than 2-1. Inslee will face pressure to try to narrow that gap. He's already gotten a taste of fundraising for the DGA. Through a public records request, we obtained a copy of Inslee's itinerary for a trip he took to Los Angeles back in April of 2015.
Let's see. I met with a representative of the Disney Corporation.
We showed Inslee a copy of his schedule from that trip to refresh his memory. Besides Disney, Inslee was scheduled to meet with other Hollywood types. The list included Lawrence Bender, best known for producing Quentin Tarantino films. Inslee said he didn't recall the details of this particular trip, but added,
I will do trips that are predominantly about raising funds for the DGA. No question about that.
The DGA is likely to raise more than $100 million for 2018 from corporations, unions, and wealthy individuals. Previous top donors to the DGA with headquarters or major operations in Washington state include Boeing, Microsoft, and Amgen. Inslee insists that rubbing shoulders with big-time donors won't influence his work as governor, but Kyle Condick with Sabato's Crystal Ball says it could aid Inslee if he aspires to national office.
The chairmanship of a big party committee is a good way to introduce oneself to big donors and big figures in your party. It's also a way to get just sort of more visibility for yourself. But Jay Inslee's probably going to be doing more national interviews and television appearances than maybe he otherwise would have done.
Inslee's already been mentioned as a possible presidential candidate in 2020. When asked, he says he's not running. For Here and Now, I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia, Washington.
The Emmy nominations are out, and Liev Schreiber has picked up his third consecutive nod as Best Actor in a Drama Series. Schreiber plays the title role in Showtime's Ray Donovan. As dreamed up by the show's creator, Ann Bitterman, Ray's a Hollywood fixer who can make almost any problem go away for the rich and famous, but who can't fix his own past or his family's problems. I spoke with Liev Schreiber about Ray Donovan last June. Season 4 was just beginning, and I asked him how it felt to be returning for a fourth season.
It feels older. It's, it's an evolution for me as an actor. I'm someone who started in the theater and really couldn't stand repeating the show. My favorite part of acting is the 5 or 6 weeks of rehearsal that you get. I like doing previews. I like the opening week because my friends and family come. And then after that, I don't want to do it anymore. So I'm not particularly suited to this job.
And yet I do it.
I'm also, as an actor, I'm not particularly suited to hard work. And this is very, very, very hard work. I've never worked so hard in my life. I worked as a mason's helper for my brother, and I remember carrying buckets of bricks up steps of brownstone to build fireplaces, and I thought that was bad, but it pales in comparison to the hours on a one-hour drama.
Well, what is so hard about this one for you in particular?
The hours. Because our show is so cinematic, we're essentially producing half of a feature film in 10 to 13 days. So we're always hustling. And it's also a very emotional show. It's a character who internalizes pain. Mm-hmm. And he's not only does he internalize pain, but he's nonverbal. So unlike Shakespeare, where you get to express through language, with Ray, and it's part of why noir is so great and so cinematic, you're not allowed language. So what you tend to do is amp up a lot of tension, build a lot of tension, and then not express it. And that can be really taxing on the body and the mind.
When you say that, by the way, I think of your role in Spotlight as Marty Baron, who also in a way internalizes certain things, and the facial expressions will tell you a lot more in sometimes than the words that you're speaking.
Yes. I think playing Ray in a funny way really helped me get ready for playing Marty. Although I don't think Marty is carrying the pain or the tension or the rage that Ray is carrying. But one thing that Marty, when I met him, that I was aware of immediately that he shares with Ray is that he's a watcher. He is able to gauge a situation very well, and he does it silently and he does it patiently. And once he's made his decision, he executes.
The other thing about these two roles is that Ray Donovan is from Southie, from South Boston.
Yes.
An insider.
And Marty's not.
And Marty is the absolute Boston outsider.
Absolutely, yeah. Which is part of the story of the film. It's kind of what made him uniquely suited to the task at hand.
Well, let's listen to a little bit for people who haven't seen this show, Ray Donovan. This is a little sense of it. Here he is. He's a fixer in Hollywood, so he can kind of get everything done from a work perspective that he needs to. But here he is persuading a talk show host to change the lineup for his show and replace Nick Jonas with an Armenian singer that no one's ever heard of. Here he is.
Hazmig's going on instead.
Hazmig?
Yeah, she's going to do a song about her great-grandfather in Armenian.
What?
You heard me.
If she wants to sing Thighs Go Boom dressed in Golame hot pants, then I will think about bumping Nick Jonas. Otherwise,
she's going to sing a song about Armenian genocide on your show tonight.
Right. And then in terms of his personal life, it seems he can't control anything. Here he is with his daughter.
You say you love me, but you don't. You say you love mom, but you don't. It's like you're not even alive inside.
You think I don't love you? Preach. Yeah. You gotta know I do anything for you.
You control, you don't love. I'm suffocating being near you, and I don't want to live with that anymore.
How do you balance those two parts of this character?
You know, ironically, for a show that is essentially a noir and fraught with sex and violence, one of the things that I love about the character that Anne created is the idea that violent people are only violent because they are vulnerable. Hmm. And that violence is a symptom of vulnerability and fear. And Ray, having suffered some pretty horrible abuse at a very early age, is carrying this around with him, carrying this kind of deep insecurity and vulnerability around with him that I think he has learned to repress and sit on, which has made him sort of a very hard character. I think it also makes violence a natural behavior for him, because there's a lot of anger and a lot of rage. So in terms of dealing with people in the sort of perverse world of the entertainment business, he has a very solid grip on both perversity and violence and dominance. But I think what's really gorgeous about the character comes out with his family, and especially his daughter Bridget, in that scene you just played. Hmm. Because she represents all of his hopes and dreams. She has already exceeded what he is and will become something so much greater than he could ever dream of. And all of his love and all of his hopes are placed in that woman, that girl. That's what I love about him, and that's what I love about the writing on the show, both from David Hollander and Ann Bitterman, that they're interested in those polarities, that duality. That's what makes great dramatic literature. I mean, that's the key to Shakespeare, is duality.
You yourself had a pretty unusual and difficult early childhood. Do you draw on your own experiences at all to sort of hold that pain in?
I think I must, but I don't know. You know, I've never been, you know, a heavy practitioner of the method, or at least with any specific intent. I'm kind of an impulse-based person. Like, you know, I'm sort of waiting for something to happen that I'm not expecting, and I'm kind of want to jump on that train of emotion or whatever it is, both from myself or from the other actor. It usually happens in the interchange between actors, or when you start playing with the rhythms of the scene or mixing it up or moving it around in ways that you're not anticipating it, then emotional things happen. And those emotional things that happen that don't have specific narrative attached to them, I think are always the most interesting ones. Now, of course, those emotions probably come from some history, but I can't remember or connect them. I just know that they exist in my body. And when I work with another good actor, they come out.
So I want to ask you about something that you probably haven't been asked about in a long, long time, but it's the way that I first got to know you as an actor, which is the movie Mixed Nuts that you did in 1994.
Yeah.
You remember that one?
I very well. What an amazing experience that was. I, you know, I got out of school. I was doing $300 a week Shakespeare in the Park. And suddenly I met Nora Ephron, who I guess saw me in a play, and she thought it would be funny to dress me up like a woman. And I agreed. And she was going to pay me in one fell swoop $70,000. I was going to pay off all of my and I had some substantial student loans. I mean, I went to a lot of school. She was going to pay off all of my student loans with one movie. Steve Martin was in it. Rob Reiner, biggest crush of my life, Madeline Kahn was in it. Not to mention that, but like the smoked fish platter that they would put out in the rehearsal room was just like beyond anything. I mean, this was my introduction to the high life, and it was a treat.
And the result for us was, let me just play a little bit. This is you playing Chris, a suicidal transvestite who shows up at a suicide prevention hotline office on Christmas Eve. And here it is.
So hurry down the chimney tonight.
Hello, Lifesavers. May I help you?
May I speak to a woman? May I please wish a woman Merry Christmas?
You are speaking to a woman.
So how many more seasons of Ray Donovan do you think you've got coming?
I don't know. You know, I think that's up to Showtime. It's up to David Hollander. For me, I personally feel like I know the business. I know how the business works. And I know that the shares or the points on the show are more valuable the more episodes you have. But I hope that everyone will also consider the creative element as well, which is to say that as long as there are stories to be told around these characters and as long as they feel compelling and coherent and important and entertaining, we'll keep doing it.
Well, Liev Schreiber, thank you so much for joining us and definitely keep doing it. We all are enjoying all of the work.
Thank you very much.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
The trust funds behind Social Security and Medicare will run out of money in less than 20 years, according to a new report from the trustees of both programs. The announcement is just the latest annual warning about the government's two largest entitlement programs, and it comes as next month marks 82 years since the Social Security Act. Jill Schlesinger is business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Her podcast is called Better Off. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
And how dire is this warning?
Well, it doesn't feel as dire because we've been getting it, as you said, year after year. Here's what we know. We know that there's this surplus, okay, that has been going on in the Social Security and the Social Security Disability Program for quite some time, meaning that there were more people paying into this than were needing benefits. And slowly but surely, this starts to shrivel as the aging baby boomers need retirement benefits and need more medical care. And so now, according to this new trustee report, the old age part of the Social Security system will be depleted by 2035, so that matches last year's projection. And after that, the system would be able to pay but just 75% of the promised benefits. The disability fund of Social Security, that would be depleted by 2028, after which the payout would be 93% of promised benefits. So it's not exactly zero, but it's not as much as many people had hoped for.
And it seems like a lot of times when people bring that up to politicians in Washington, they say, you know, well, we'll deal with it by then.
Yeah. And maybe that's part of the problem because it feels like it's so far off. However, I would just like to note that my Social Security retirement age seems to match the exact year of depletion. So therefore, I'm interested.
You're very
in this.
Worried.
Yes. Now, I'm not worried. I'm not worried for a couple of reasons, okay? This is a known problem. And so when people go really nutty, they'll say, oh my God, Social Security is going broke. But as you heard me just say, we're not going broke. We're saying we can't pay as much as we had promised. And the other piece of this that is incredibly important is that these are problems that have basically mathematical solutions. There are ways to fix the problems. And it may be that people don't like the fixes, but there are solutions.
And what about Medicare, by the way? This is the government health plan for people over 65 and some people with disabilities.
Well, I mean, I think Medicare is a tougher problem because Medicare Part A, which is the hospital services, that's going to be depleted by 2029 and, you know, would only pay out 88% of the expected benefits. But what's more important is that because healthcare costs are rising, the trustees are projecting that the Medicare problem is a much bigger problem than the Social Security problem.
So what are the possible solutions here, and are any politically feasible?
Yes. And so let me just be clear that if you think about this, again, it's a math problem. Let's not talk about politics. So here's one way to do it. Right now, the way Social Security is funded is through our FICA taxes. And you pay taxes, 6.2%. Every employee pays that, and an employer pays another 6.2%. And you go up to an earnings limit. It's currently $127,200. So one thing you could do is you could say, well, instead of $127,200, you could make it $150,000. Right. So you're going to pay more in taxes. You could also say instead of 6.2% tax onto that limit, we'll make it 6.5%. You could also say you got to retire a little bit later. Some machination there. There is a solution. We're not going broke. Everyone take a deep breath.
Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money, and someone whose retirement age matches up perfectly with this story. Jill, thank you.
Take care.
One of our colleagues recently got her Stitch Fix box and a trying-on party broke out. Let's back up. Stitch Fix is a subscription and personal shopping service. It's been around since 2011. You fill out a long questionnaire, like a dating survey, your likes and dislikes. It also asks for your measurements. They then, using your profile, send you clothes they think you'll like. You keep what you do and send back the rest. Amazon is also starting its own pay-for-what-you-keep service, Prime Wardrobe. This is just one new innovation in the booming online retail world. That's now about 20% of the market. It got us thinking, how are people buying their clothing, and how's the retail world reacting? Sucharita Molperu is a retail analyst who joins us again from Charlotte, North Carolina. Sucharita, start with these pay-for-what-you-keep services. You give them a profile. They mail you clothing. Tell us more.
A few years ago, some companies that were venture capital funded, so they were startups, started doing essentially what I call the subscription model. But yeah, you fill out a survey from your measurements to the types of brands that you like, and then they will send you things in the mail. You don't have to pay for anything up front, and you only pay for what you keep, and they give you a huge, basically, a mailing package to send everything you don't want back if you choose not to keep anything. Now, if you don't keep anything, you have to pay something like a $20 fee, but if you do keep anything, even one thing, you can apply that $20 toward whatever you keep.
Well, I don't know if I could stand this, because I fall in love with something. I see it, and I fall in love with it, and I want it. I can't imagine giving that experience over to someone else.
Yeah, no, I don't think that this is at all meant to replace the mall or the physical experience. Yeah. Exactly, or the catalog. I think that really it's about exposing shoppers to things that they may not have seen before. And that's really what these stylists promise, is that it's often unknown brands or new products that may not be familiar to you. Discovery in a new way is really the idea here.
Well, boy, I tell you, the discovery we've witnessed as our colleagues open the box and there's this item that fits them perfectly, and they're seeing it for the first time, what the stylist has picked out for them. So it's worked for them. And is this what we call the out-of-the-box experience?
Yeah, yeah. And it's so popular that you have all these YouTube videos now called unboxing videos that show people actually taking their products out of the box that they've received in the mail, and they describe it in excruciating detail. And some of these videos will have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of views, which is baffling to me, but there are people who find this entertaining. So yeah, it is that out-of-the-box experience, which is often one of the most important ones, because it's this sense of, this is great, this is cool, this is what I have been looking forward to, is this, you know, being surprised and delighted in the mail.
But you've recently written about how retailers should not overlook what happens next, how they send things back, that returns is a big area now where stores are competing. Talk about that.
consumers, they will often choose not to return because it's such a frustrating experience. And if a retailer can make it super easy and super seamless, which is what some of these subscription services like Stitch Fix do superbly, they actually take some of that friction out of the returns process.
And you say everybody should be like Nordstrom. It sets the bar, particularly with the no questions asked return policy. You said that's what consumers want. And then they'll switch companies. You know, they'll return something and then switch to another company. If they're not treated well in the return process, and you say no questions asked is a part of that, pay for their returns, as you just said, maybe have in-store returns. What else are retailers missing out on in mining this area, the returns?
Well, all of those things that you just mentioned. I mean, a lot of retailers still have things like restocking fees, which is crazy to me, that basically if you're going to send something back that you have to pay like a $5 fee, in some cases even more than that. There's also some levels, some opportunities on where you can actually physically return a product. And what we're seeing is some businesses that even if you purchase at an online-only store, you may be able to return a product at your local Walgreens or even your local grocery store.
How do companies make any money if they offer free shipping and free returns?
Well, the apparel industry is a little bit different because their margins have always been amongst the highest in all of retail. So the margin is definitely a part of it. And some of these online stores can survive by offering the free returns because they don't have the physical infrastructure, right? They don't have to pay for, you know, kind of the top dollar rent at a local shopping mall. And that saves money as well.
Talk about online marketplaces that are popping up. Farfetch, List.
So that's another newer type of model. So we talked about subscription models. Marketplaces are essentially businesses where you don't have to own any inventory, but you can sell other people's products. So this is pretty revolutionary in retail because it really hadn't happened before until the internet made it possible. And Farfetch is a really interesting example because what they do is they take, it's sort of like Airbnb for fashion, and they take all of these very high-end luxury fashion boutiques around the world that are physical stores in really posh neighborhoods. And they are able to aggregate all of these products and feature them on Farfetch.com. And Farfetch just basically takes a cut of every transaction that happens, and it exposes these boutiques to a global audience, really. So that's a new approach. And List is similar. They have a slightly different approach. They're working with other retailers, but the idea is the same, is that you take a cut of the transactions that you are able to generate on this platform, essentially.
Well, you talk about boutiques, and it sounds like that's a huge trend now. We're reading elsewhere that Target, for instance, is realizing that shoppers want to feel there's something special, that there's, you know, some sort of niche that's just there for them. So Target is completely revamping, getting rid of the Merona and Mossimo lines. Those of us who've enjoyed Target know that, you know, every now and then there's just the greatest T-shirt or the greatest hat or scarf from these lines. But Target's feeling they're just getting old and doing what?
Yeah, what Target has decided to do is basically give their private label a refresh. And you're absolutely right, Robin. I mean, Target was, you know, kind of this aspirational brand, even though it was a mass merchant for so many years. And it's lost a little bit of its cachet, in part because companies like Amazon have been growing so quickly. And I think what they've realized is that they need to go back to how can they be aspirational? And it's time to refresh.
Well, we're seeing a quote from Target's chief merchandising officer. People want something that's more curated and meaningful and feels just special to them. And this is what Target's trying to do to keep them from online shopping. Meanwhile, we're noting that the United States has the most brick-and-mortar retail space of any other developed country in the world. And, of course, we know those stores are closing left and right. People are saying the U.S. is overstored, too many stores. Is that because there were too many stores, you know, stores just that went up everywhere? Or is it because online shopping is closing the stores?
It is see all of the above. Just even in the last 20 years, we've actually had 40,000 new shopping centers. So not only were we overstored to start with, but we kept building. And then online is unquestionably the other big factor. Every time a transaction happens on those online sites, that's one less transaction that happens in a physical store. And there is a third factor, too, that I would say, which is that over the last 30 years, we've actually seen the average price point of the average apparel item go down, inflation adjusted, I mean. And the reason for that is Chinese manufacturing. And that has not only made it so much more affordable to have a closet full of clothes, but what that means is that any given retailer makes less money. Mm-hmm. And that's the challenge that these stores have to face.
Well, Amazon is now poised to become the largest apparel retailer in the country. Quite something. Sucharita Mulparu. Sucharita is an independent retail analyst. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When the Trump administration threatened to take away federal money from cities and towns that declared themselves sanctuary cities, many of those jurisdictions doubled down on protecting people living in the country illegally. They said they would not become arms of the federal government by cooperating with the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. But a recent spike in gang violence in Northern Virginia has led some police departments there to decide to work side by side with immigration agents. Armando Truhl from Here and Now contributor WAMU spent a day with the unit on a recent operation and has this report.
Copy that. Thanks, bro. Heroes waiting in the parking lot.
Five undercover police vehicles are staking out a high school in Herndon, Virginia. They have a warrant for a specific youth who they say is an MS-13 gang member. The Latino gang is active in many Central American immigrant communities around the United States and is known for its violence. Lieutenant Evan Weeks is with the Fairfax County Police Department.
He's known to frequent this location, this school, and the parking lot. The last intelligence we got was he's been here trying to start trouble with a rival gang member or rival gang.
Trouble is the last thing officers want, especially in a high school parking lot.
Because when these two gangs interact, it always results in some kind of violence or potential violence down the road.
Weeks says the plan is for police officers belonging to the Northern Virginia Gang Task Force to make the arrest and turn the suspect over to ICE agents waiting in two of the cars.
Because he's been confirmed to be a criminal street gang member here illegally.
The suspect never shows, so after an hour or so, the combined squad of police officers and ICE agents head out to look for other targets with outstanding warrants on their list.
These are people who have come to the country illegally, who've been arrested and convicted for felonies and deported, and they've come back into our country illegally again.
The agency is up here. So SRO is going to be walking around trying to see if we can find out where he's hanging out at.
Officers spot a couple of suspected gang members hanging out in a park. They jump out of the car, detain and question them. The officers wear bulletproof vests. Those who are undercover have black masks. One suspect says he is from Guatemala, the other from El Salvador. Police officers compare notes on the identity of the young men who appear to be in their late teens.
That other guy, I guess he had a warrant for a burglary from you guys.
Which one?
This one.
Herndon Police Sergeant Claudio Sa has been busting gang members for more than two decades and recognizes one of the suspects.
That's your boy, right?
From back in the day.
The youth are hustled into a nice van and driven off. The sweep continues, and so does my conversation with Officer Sa. He blames the bloody three-way war in El Salvador between the MS-13 gang, its rival, Barrio 18, and the police for the gang violence in our region.
Killing somebody is a requirement.
To be a member.
To be a member, yeah. Which has changed from what it was 10 years ago.
And why do you think that is?
Violence. Just violence. Because this particular gang wants to be the biggest, baddest, most feared gang in the world.
The conversation is cut short when the team spots another suspected MS-13 gang member. This one is a 16-year-old from El Salvador who arrived here alone 2 years ago to be reunited with his mother.
Please, done. Okay. Well, he's under arrest.
It's begun raining, but the youth's mother and sisters come out and plead with officers. I tell the mother The police claim he is a gang member. She denies it. Still, ICE takes him away. I speak to a masked officer with the Northern Virginia Gang Task Force. He asks that we not use his name because he works undercover. He says the youth, who was wearing an electronic tracking bracelet, was under house arrest and shouldn't have been outside.
This is a Herndon clique of MS called Indios Locos Salvatrucha, which is ILS. They're based, obviously, in El Salvador, but they also had hierarchy in Hempstead, New York. And they end up, we started an investigation that moved into Virginia where they were trying to take over the Virginia Herndon area.
He says the gangs take over a neighborhood by marking their territory with graffiti and enforcing the MS-13 motto, Mata, Viola, Controla, kill, rape, control. Lieutenant Weeks agrees. He says these gangs have a stranglehold on Latino neighborhoods in Northern Virginia.
Those are people we're targeting. Or why we're working in conjunction with immigration, custom enforcement.
Critics of these combined operations between local police and ICE say they sow fear and have a chilling effect on community cooperation with law enforcement. Weeks disagrees. He says it allows Latino communities besieged by gangs to breathe easier because it gets dangerous criminals off the street quickly. The hope, he says, is that by deporting these gang members, they'll never prey on people in these neighborhoods again. For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Welcome back. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.